This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are going over a Game of Thrones, the three heads of the dragon, in theory. It is Tyrion, Jon, and Daenerys. Our first ever POV chapter of Tyrion. Mm-hmm. Then Jon gets abused by Catelyn. And Daenerys gets married and gets dragon eggs. Very pivotal chapter.
Absolutely. It's very exciting. Can't wait to dive in.
Yeah, so why we're so eager about these chapters?
Well, it's a lot of things that are happening, and you get to see a lot more of Tyrion because, yeah, you only see from other people's point of views, and it's actually very surprising when you see things from his point of view, the way that he is, the kind of person that he is. He's very, very deep. I say.
And in going off of, you know, these potential three heads of the dragons, one thing I noticed, again, a common theme is, as you mentioned in a previous episode, Jon is very much an observer. But in a way, both Tyrion is also an observer and Daenerys is also an observer. All of these, for various reasons, whether they're a bastard socially disabled or physically disabled like Tyrion, or again, disabled as a woman, all of these three characters been put on the sidelines, and from that they observe things without people necessarily knowing that they're being observed.
Yeah, this is exactly it. And also, you know, not being, because I'm not the very deepest, because I do love a wedding. So looking at Daenerys's wedding through her point of view is really interesting.
Yes, indeed. So first, let us begin with Tyrion. I really took note of the fact that George R. R. Martin wanted to introduce Tyrion as in the library with a book, and knowing about the books almost as much as well, if not knowing the books better than the archivist there. And so it was just interesting, the notion of, like, you know, as much as a drunk as Tyrion is, as lecherous as he is, as for all the other various elements of his personality, in his first POV chapter, it's showing us his intellectual side with the books.
That's exactly it. It, you know, from the other chapters, we have seen him being described as a, you know, funny looking man who loves to drink. And I don't know if they have mentioned about him, you know, being, you know, whoring around or whatever. But you don't think that this man has any substance to it. So opening the chapter in the library where he's reading books and where he's actually instructing the scepter there? What's his name? Chael, I think his name is, the maester there. Yeah. About how to actually store the books and how, you know, those scripts are Valyrian and very, you know, very precious and very delicate. You do start to see that he has different layers. That's what I really love about Tyrion. He's just not one thing.
And it goes in that same vein as a lot of comedians are actually quite deep, whether like very deep or actually went through traumatic circumstances to make them go through the using comedy as a shield. Because I think, who was it? Tiffany Haddish, you know that?
Yes, she's hilarious.
She's hilarious, but I think part of it is is her mother like had this accident where like she became brain dead or something really, really horrible like happened in her childhood. And she ended up explained it as she watched the movie, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And Roger Rabbit was explaining, you know, laughter can be a very powerful thing. Sometimes it's the only weapon we have. Mm-hmm. And she took that to heart. It's like, okay, if I can just get these people to laugh, then I can, you know, have them eating out of my hand. And likewise with Tyrion, and again, another tragic case, Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yes, bless him. It still impacts me when I think and watch his films and I think about him. It was he suffered very deeply from depression, which I know very much about. And
I felt extra. Yeah, I've been thinking about him specifically because I recently watched Dead Poets Society. And in that movie, one of his character's students commits suicide. So the horrible parallel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredibly sad. And he has given us a lot of joy. It's a shame that he wasn't feeling it himself. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So yeah, Tyrion is, you know, sort of following that sort of using comedy as a shield because in a way it's not so much a choice that he is forced to use comedy because that comedy and mockery and laughter is what people give him because of his physical disability or, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He diverts, and the fact that he's so very well read as well, he sees the value of that, of being knowledgeable about different things that go on in the world, and especially, I guess, about himself. Maybe he has researched things in the books that have given an insight about who he is. You know, he wanted to show the world that he wasn't a lay-by of society, I guess. He had more to give, apart from, you know, his wealth, because he does come from a wealthy family.
And I'm just thinking, you know, again, he knows all these books, and clearly he likes books and likes reading and knows a lot about it. I'm just thinking, are the Maesters celibate, or...
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
They are? Okay, because I'm thinking, why didn't Tyrion become a Maester? Because I think that could be a balance, again, of him using his talent, his intellectual talents over to compensate for what's perceived as lacking in physical talents. And that could be a way for Tywin to sort of hide him away, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they basically did the same thing, you know, to, you know, Maester Aemon at Castle Black, you know, in essence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. But they are meant to be celibate. As we know, in this world, not a lot of them are, especially Pycelle, which we'll get to, you know, later on in the books.
But yeah, I was just thinking about that. Like, he could have been a maester, but I don't
know. Or maybe he was pushed to do so, but he's very headstrong. He was like, absolutely not. Mm. You never know.
Yeah, because I know definitely in college, my freshman year, I took a History of Venice class. And it was very much a pattern that if you had a very inconvenient female relative, like a daughter that you didn't have a dowry for or things like that, you would just shovel them off to the convent and hide them away.
Wow.
So like, you know, always for both male and female religious institutions have been where we have dumped our undesirables in society.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really sad. It's really sad. And well, you know, nowadays it's still like that, especially in certain cultures. It's sad because putting people out there in the world is a very serious situation. I don't think people take it as seriously as it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And then doesn't want to deal with the consequences.
Indeed. So Tyrion knows all this stuff, and just him lecturing the Maester about the handling of the scrolls, it reminded me of, mm-hmm. I recently read a nonfiction book called, what is it? The Library Book, which was the whole like sort of kind of true crime nonfiction story about the Central Library in Los Angeles. It caught on fire in 1986, and a good 500,000 books burned beyond repair. Wow. And like another 700,000 were damaged. And it was potentially an arson. So they had a guy that a lot of circumstantial evidence heavily suggested that he set the library on fire, but there was nothing concrete, and so they couldn't convict him. And then by the end, they didn't really want to push it too hard because the guy was already dying of AIDS anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But sad. Through all that book, thinking about, again, how, especially fire, the worst possible thing for a library.
Yes, absolutely.
And thinking of those Valyrian scrolls are very dry and of just one mat.
Yeah, just like rubbing two straws together will set fire to it.
Yeah. But Tyrion eventually makes his way out of the archive or library and meets the Hound and Joffrey in, the courtyard where they're, practicing or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first read it, I remember being quite surprised how verbatim this scene was in the show.
Yes, absolutely. It's word for word. It's, scene by scene. It's just very...
Peter Dinklage? Is that his mm-hmm. last name? Yeah. Well, I'm really happy because I like a lot of... I like if... when film adaptations, use as much as possible verbatim, but sometimes certain actors, again, in certain roles, it seems forced if they're trying to do a certain, mm-hmm. A certain dialogue that's already been written out in a book and, Peter does it very well and has it be very realistic and fluid where it totally makes sense. That's what he's saying. And he's like, one word and I hit you again.
Yes. He is like the role was made for him, I feel. Mm-hmm. Although, he was probably a child when that came out, or a young adult, but he does it very well.
Yeah. And then there's the whole discussion of, for as attractive as Peter Dinklage is compared to how Tyrion is described in the book, but.
Oh yeah. 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 And especially later on when he gets slashed in the face.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's just
they let him keep his nose.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So I was just thinking, we have this toss back and forth where Tyrion is scolding Joffrey because he's not doing mm-hmm. his princely duties. And I'm just thinking, well, Tyrion is lecturing Joffrey and I'm like, where has Cersei been that Cersei hasn't taught Joffrey that, you don't have to genuinely care about them, but you do need to go through these motions.
I don't think Cersei cares about the Starks. I don't think she cares about them. So that's why I don't think she has taught that. I don't think she thinks it's worth for him to go and... for her, it's very much family first. So mm-hmm. to me, it seems to me that all she cares about is the Lannisters and not about alliances and... I think we were discussing that yesterday. She and Jamie are very much impulsive people.
Yeah,
so she doesn't think of the big picture.
Again, so I found that interesting. And then, but clearly Joffrey has a little bit of fear and maybe quasi-respect for mm-hmm. Tyrion because he ultimately goes and does it.
Well, yeah, after he gets slapped a couple of times,
He
does it. I think that, Tyrion obviously doesn't think very highly of Joffrey, so it's not the first time that Joffrey has been a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. And it's just fully disrespectful. So I think this is not the first time that Tyrion has to resort to that.
Yeah, well, I think, in my head canon, I like to think that, similar situations have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei has bitched about it, but ultimately Robert didn't do anything about it, so...
Yeah.
So Tyrion learned that, it doesn't matter if Cersei gets pissed off to a certain extent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he just doesn't care, really.
Yeah. If anything, Robert likes it when Cersei is pissed off.
yeah, I think so. He honestly, Robert doesn't care. He doesn't care about his family. As we see in this chapter, when Tyrion asks where he is, if he's still sleeping, and she goes, no, he's with Ned, that the fall that happened to Bran has hit him very hard. So, he just really doesn't care about that side of the family. He doesn't care.
Yeah. So the prince will remember that, little lord, the Hound warned him. The helm turned his laugh into a hollow rumble. I pray he does, Tyrion Lannister replied. If he forgets, be a good dog and remind him.
Mm-hmm. This is also the first time that we... Is it the first time that we heard... Well, that we've seen people refer to him as the Hound, Sandor Clegane.
Is it? Because I know he had that interaction with, Jon and Arya were watching from the window. Rob and Joffrey and Sandor Clegane was in there being like, they should be fighting with real swords. They need to toughen up. Mm-hmm. But was he specifically referred to as the Hound? I am unsure.
I don't remember. I don't think so, because we were looking at from Arya's point of view, so I don't think they referred him to his name. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, we're looking at from Tyrion's side, who's more close to the Hound himself. So, right. You know, it's all described as the Hound, and we see a lot of sort of his personality, well, the Hound's personality, and he mm-hmm. seems just quite cruel, but not respected at all. So being referred to as a dog.
Yeah, which is just constantly. Interesting because I don't know, like in a genuine medieval context, but like I consider a hound to be like of a, like not in the same derogatory way as like just purely like dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think the hound has a connotation to it, but it seems like he's embraced it because he does wear the helmet
mm-hmm.
that is shaped like a dog's head. And yeah, I don't think he cares much, but yeah, he's just quite cruel, just saying, you know, I wish that Bran would die would die quickly. And then when Joffrey was like, well, at least he's dying quietly, it's the dire wolf that is howling away. And he just goes, I can silence the beast for you.
Yeah, and Tyrion's like, the Starks can count past 6.
yeah, unlike some princes.
Dude, burn.
I know. I love Tyrion. He just
like Tyrion and Lady Olenna in terms of the shade.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Those two together, I would watch a roast, like them doing a roast of everyone.
So Tyrion totters off, you know, into, you know, where they're having breakfast, and it's Cersei, Jaime, and of course the kids, Tommen and mm-hmm. Marcella. And of course talking about, you know, Bran's fall, and you know, what does the Maester say? Like, he actually might live, he might not, mm-hmm. and Tyrion notices a glance between Cersei and Jaime. Mm-hmm. And this just makes me wonder how, obviously Tyrion's aware of their like their relationship, of course, and has known for a while. But is he aware that they were in that tower that specific time? Is he aware that possibly there could be a link? Like, he notices something that clearly Cersei is concerned that Bran might not die.
I think he does, because of the fact that at the end of the chapter he says, I hope the boy does wake. I would be most interested to hear what he might have said, what he might have to say. So he knows that those two were involved in it somehow.
Yeah. Because
then Jaime soured up, and then he was just like, you think you hate us? And he's like, I don't know what you mean. I love my family.
Well, I think it's also one of those situations that Jaime took the bait, where it's like, who told you? And it's like, you did just now.
Yeah. It might have just been,
you know, that sort of mind fuckery as well. Mm-hmm. And also, I think just general process of elimination, that Tyrion knows that, you know, in this kid's home, this kid has been climbing for years. Mm. Who are the only people who have a secret that they wouldn't want to let out, and who has the capacity to do that to a little kid? Those two.
Or, you know, who wasn't on the ride? Everyone went on the ride apart from Jaime and Cersei. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the smaller kids and the girls.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the girls that would have pushed their brother, would it?
No. So, I'm just trying to think. The only other note in this chapter I have is just Jaime's sort of, again, dismissal of, oh, you know, I would have wanted a clean death myself. And of course, all the ableism in this, which I just think is funny, because obviously Jaime, you know, learns to let that go because he himself becomes a cripple in a way. And, you know, he goes through that whole redemption and transformation. But it's just funny he takes this attitude, because Tyrion has already shown that that Jaime was one of the very few people who showed him respect and cared about him. So there is that already in Jaime, that capacity to see someone, even if they're not the society's notion of like normal, that he sees the value in them. So he already sees that in Tyrion. So the fact that he's so like yucky, you know, about the Brand situation, I'm just like,
Yeah, but although I don't think that he truly means it, he's just saying it because I guess it's like wishful thinking that the boy will die and then he won't wake up to tell anyone what happened. So I think that's what he means. It's just
so he's cloaking his like internal motivation with this sort of toxic masculine statement that he's expected to say as a knight in his prime.
Yes, that's exactly it. I don't think he has I don't think he's that deep, you know, into I think he takes people at face value. Like he took his brother at face value. He was just like, oh, he's just a dwarf, like it doesn't matter. I don't think he takes things very seriously. Well, as Tyrion says, he doesn't. So I think he's just saying it to, like you said, mask the fact that, you know, internally that's what he doesn't want people to find out.
Yes, and again, as we said, you wound me. You know how much I love my family.
Yeah. Ah, I do love Tyrion.
And then we get to Jon. And definitely this is the chapter where I realized when I first read it, the stark contrast between book Catelyn and movie or TV show Catelyn. And I'm just like, oh my God, I hate this bitch so much. Because all the other chapters going back and forth, you know, as an outsider and again, you know, playing the game a little bit compared to Ned Stark, you know, I didn't necessarily see those things as bad qualities. But when we got to this chapter, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. Holy shit. My first note of this chapter is Catelyn is a huge bitch.
And mine is Catelyn is such a bitch.
Well, there you go then. I was going to say another word, but it's a bit strong. It's a bit strong, even though we are reading Game of Thrones, and that word might come up. But yeah, she is way more than a bitch, but I can't say anymore. I hate her, man. I hate her so much.
And she's so self-centered because, again, Jon isn't doing this to antagonize her. He tried really hard to wait until she left.
Yeah.
But she won't leave. And so when Jon goes in, because he wants to say goodbye to his little brother.
Yeah.
And again, she is, again,
she's just awful.
In this scene specifically, her sort of selfish notion of motherhood is very much like Cersei's.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's about like my child, no one else, don't care about anyone else. Like, remember when, well, it's going to be later on, I guess. So I don't know if we should talk about it. But yeah, it's very much, you know, it's us, our family against everyone. And, you know, I was just saying, like, it's like you said, Jon has been like really afraid to see his brother because of Catelyn, because she won't leave his side, and like he wanted to come earlier, but because of her. So like, can you imagine what hell she put him through in his early years to make him that scared of like even being in the same room as her?
Yeah, it's, and she's like, I've come to say goodbye. You've said it, now go away. And what did she say, you know?
She said, I told you to leave. We don't want you here, because he moved inside the room and he was like, please. And she's like, I told you to leave. We don't want you here. And who called the guards?
Who? What's this we? Bran did not say any. This we is like, she may not like the situation, but is she so blind? Like, she's been around long enough to observe that her kids get along. With the exception of maybe Sansa, all the other kids pretty much get along with Jon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she is just so self-involved that she doesn't see that, how good it is for her to get along with Jon just for the sake of the kids. She's not seeing that because she's so like self-involved and just cares about herself.
Mm-hmm. So Rob gets along with John because they're both boys the same age. Arya gets along with John because they're kind of outsiders. Bran, we don't get too much interaction between John and Bran, but we know from Bran, you know, in later books and remembering John, we know Bran got along with John. Yeah, again, everyone except Catelyn and Sansa got along with John.
Yeah, yeah. And from Bran in the, in his first chapter where John is giving him advice and he's taking it, you know, and he's like, you know, and then when John said it was, you know, talking to Ned about the kids keeping the dire wolves, and, you know, Bran was really happy and very thankful to John. So it wasn't like he was treating him bad. So, yeah, it, you know, everyone gets along with John.
And John has the intelligence, emotional intelligence, to realize, you know, and may have feelings from resentments and stuff, but he doesn't pin that all like on his siblings. He gets along with his siblings and is just upset and sad about the situation. Where Catelyn, instead of being, you know, being the adult and just accepting that, oh, this is a situation I don't like, she just externalized all of it on John himself.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. She's disgusting, man. She's disgusting. Like, she must have been so nasty to him. So nasty. It just, you know, when she says, I told you to leave, we don't want you here. And he said, you know, the narration from him says, once that would have sent him running, once that might even made him cry. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Can you imagine being so cruel to a child?
Yeah. And yeah, it's terrible. So Catelyn is like, I wanted him to stay here with me. And, you know, basically talking about how she feels guilty. And felt like, you know, the gods gave me what I want. And he's like, it wasn't your fault. And she's
He's still kind. He's still kind to her. After all of that, he's still respectful and kind and listening to her. Because I would have said, you know what, bitch, peace. See you later.
And it's like, I need none of your absolution, bastard. And it's like, why are you... Again, I guess I'm wondering, is her, like, shock over Bran and stuff, is this making her better or is this making her worse?
Oh, worse, definitely worse.
Yeah,
it's making her worse.
Because it's, again, this could have been an opportunity, again, if she didn't see it in everyday life, see that, oh, like, you know, I don't have to worry about John being in competition. John really cares about my children. I can use him, even if not in a purely emotional, like, morally good, just, you know, tolerating him. It's like, I can use him as an asset in protecting my children.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But she doesn't. She doesn't care. She thinks that, you know, he is sort of polluting their family, doesn't want him anywhere near her kids, doesn't want him anywhere near anyone.
Yeah,
just wants him to go.
So she's incapable of taking comfort in the fact that even though she has been awful to this kid, he still cares about her son and all of those things. And it's just...
I was just going to say that. The worst thing that she could possibly say, she calls him John, first of all, as he's leaving, she calls him John, which he says she never called him John before, so obviously he turns, and then she says, it should have been you. Oh,
yeah. That is awful. That, honestly, that reminds me of, who is it? Lord of the Rings, Denethor, you know, the father of Boromir and Faramir. Boromir, also played by Sean Bean.
Yes.
You know, when Boromir dies and Denethor basically, you know, Faramir says, you would have preferred that I had died and Boromir have lived. And Denethor's like, yes, I wish that.
Yeah, it's so nasty to say. It's just a horrible, she's a horrible fucking person.
Yeah, and again, it's so gross in any other way. And I don't know what else we could say about it, except, you know, John eventually leaves and he catches up with Rob. And John is like, John says, you know, Rob has an inclination, like, my mom, like, obviously is smart enough to tell that they don't get along. And all John says is that she was very kind. And I'm just like, no, it's one thing to, like, not say anything to this woman who's grieving as much as a bitch as she being. But in terms of, like, again, with my peer, with Rob, like, I would not be, like, trying to cover her ass.
Yeah, I just think he doesn't want ill feelings towards her. He's just like, this is a thing between me and her, and I just don't want you involved. But you can see that she has been nasty to him in front of the kids as well, at least in front of Rob and Sansa, because, well, Sansa picked up on it, and she's emulating her mum, and Rob knows that something is wrong. You know, he not that something is wrong, but that, you know, he went to see Bran and she was going to be there. So something must have occurred. You know, the kids have an idea of how she is towards Jon. And it's just horrible. Just horrible. You are a grown up. You're an adult. It's just...
Yeah, it's... Ugh. So Jon says his farewell to Rob, and then he goes and says goodbye to Arya, which, again, very sweet interaction. Mm. Poor Arya, like... Although, I would be, like, Septa Mordain, where it's like, you better fold those clothes, because, like, having... Like, just throwing wrinkled clothes in a suitcase, like, I don't like it.
But what is it to Septa Mordain? Like, she's not going to iron their clothes, is she?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But Jon gives her the present of Needle.
Mm-hmm. It just shows how much of a connection that they have, that he truly sees her for who she wants to be and how she wants to carry her life. And he gives her a sword, even though it's not very... It is like a custom-made sword as well. It's not like he went and just took one. It's a custom-made sword specially for her that he went and got it made because he sees her as she truly is.
Yeah, and it's just interesting to see, again, you know, it's said that Arya looks more like Lyanna and Jon looks more like a Stark, and that, you know, Sansa and Rob, you know, have the Tully... you know, red hair. So there's already this divide in the Starks about, you know, North versus South.
Yeah. So it that their connection is really special, I feel. It's just really sad to have them separate like that.
Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, they wanted... George R. R. Martin was thinking maybe he would make Jon and Arya have an incestuous relationship like Cersei and Jaime, but that got kiboshed.
Oh, thank God. This is disgusting. It's just no. It's just wrong. I don't understand why he needs to put incest on everything. Yeah. One thing that I noticed as well, now that, you know, everyone's going their separate ways, is that we never see Jon interact with Ned, apart from that brief moment in Bran's chapter in the beginning. And it would have been interesting to see, because now we see like how Catelyn reacts towards him and how you know, the kids react towards him. It would have been interesting to see how Ned interacts with Jon. But maybe that would have given away.
And honestly, like, sometimes, you know, again, the whole theory with Jon's parentage, at first I was thinking, okay, it would kind of make sense that Ned didn't say anything to Catelyn, like, when they were first married, because, again, they were still getting to know each other and something. But once they were, like, married for good, like, why didn't he tell Catelyn? But I'm thinking, if Catelyn was being this much of a bitch, because I don't think, if I have a much more negative interpretation of Catelyn and her behavior, and the sense of, you know, in some ways, I don't think telling her the truth, it depends on how you view her, like, jealousy as being more of genuinely jealous of what Jon represents as this other woman, or Catelyn just being, like, angry about being embarrassed, you know, the facade of the fact that there's a bastard living with her children. So depending on that motivation, because a lot of times I think it wouldn't have mattered if Ned had told her the truth, because it's like, you have to keep it secret, obviously, so she would still be enduring the society would still think that this is a bastard, so socially nothing would change. Like, it would only make her change her, like, attitude or behavior if her issues were much more, like, emotional in regards to her relationship with Ned, which I don't... Again, I flip back and forth, you know, between readings. And at this point, I'm thinking more, it's more about the facade of everything.
Yeah. I think it's the facade of everything. I do think that her behavior towards Jon would have been better, because she resents the way that he looks, because he looks more like Ned than her kids do, and, you know, all this parentage situation. But again, the parentage situation, I think she would have resented him a bit more because it's Lyanna. So then it's like, it's very legitimate.
Oh, so in a way, having the ghost of Lyanna would be worse than the ghost of this random woman?
Yeah, because it is he would be like a legitimate Stark child that could take away everything from them, from her children.
That is possible, because, again, in terms of whether it's a boy or a girl, but Lyanna was older, so...
Yeah.
Older than Ned, however you interpret those. Okay. Anyway, yeah. I got off, but of course we, you know, that chapter ends with John giving her needle, and then we move on to Daenerys. The big wedding scene.
Yeah, yeah. A terrifying wedding, from the sounds of it.
Yeah, the a Dothraki wedding without at least three deaths is considered a dull affair.
Amazing. Isn't that the truth for everything?
Oh, no. I really honed in on the first sentence. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendor in a field beyond the walls of Pentos, for the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. As a pagan, I just kind of resonated. It's like, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes it more spiritual, yeah. I want to say, you know.
Because it's, again, it's natural for our nomadic people to have a more pagan-like, earth-based spirituality, mm-hmm. because their entire survival, their entire way of being revolves around the elements.
Yeah, the Mughals, I think, the Mughals worship the moon as well. So it mm-hmm. is that sort of, very earth-like.
Honestly, I have in my notes here that Viserys is basically acting like a bridesmaidzilla.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of those nightmares.
Yeah, like basically a person in the wedding party who thinks it's supposed to be all about them and not the bride. And it's like, mm-hmm. what are you smoking?
I know, but I mean, did we think it was going to go any other way for Viserys?
Yeah. So, no, of course not. Because again, this is already demeaning enough to him that he has to lower himself to use Daenerys as a bargaining chip because they literally have nothing else left.
But you know, he still thinks like this is an object that I'm giving away. Why is it no more of a celebration of me?
Indeed, like just not can't stand the fact that he's seated lower than Dany Drogo and the Blood Riders.
Yes, yeah, exactly. He's just... But I think what pisses him off the most is because he's sitting lower than his sister, this object that he gave away.
Yeah, even though it's her wedding, yeah, it's just...
Yeah, pathetic.
Yep, and so what does she get? She gets lots of presents, jewels, let me see what we got. Jorah, of course, gives her the books in the common tongue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, bless her. Throughout the whole like time that she has been, you know, in this wedding, because it goes from like dawn until dusk, the wedding, and you know, it's a bunch of things happening, like dancing and drinking, and then they start like
killing each other.
Yeah, having sex, and then and then men like touch the same woman, and then they start killing each other. Like a dozen men died, and she's just like terrified, that she keeps repeating in her head, like, I am the blood of the dragon, I am the let's just, you know, give herself the strength to get through everything.
And she can't eat anything because she knows she's just gonna throw it back up.
Yeah, so she's just been drinking and
and I was just thinking about, just again with this whole splendid Dothraki scene, I was just thinking about the language of Dothraki, mm-hmm. because the guy who invented it, and I kind of already knew this beforehand, because the minute I heard the Dothraki speak on the show, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, the guy who did this language, he knows Arabic. Because mm-hmm. in Arabic, the word for I is Anna, and in Dothraki, mm-hmm. it's Anha.
Oh, yeah.
So I was just thinking just the notion of Dothraki and all the influence it got. And I remember one actor in the show who was playing like one of the Dothraki or like one of the Blood Riders, he was basically on an interview behind the scenes, who was like, it's basically a combination of Arabic and German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very, very gruff and
guttural. Very
guttural. Yeah, and the R's. Mm-hmm. And the rolling of the R's. Sounds like saying arse. It's not arse. It's arse. The letter R's.
Yeah. Our big British American difference are ours.
yeah. There's a really funny joke by this comedian. He's called Mickey Flanagan, and he's from this place in the UK called Essex. And the way that they say house is like ours, right?
Ours. Yeah.
And then he said that he went on a date with this girl in New York, and then when they when they went back to her house, he really needed to go to the toilet, I think he was. And then he just says, "Let me come into your house." And then she was like, "I'm sorry, what?" And it's like, "Come on, let me come into your house."
Oh my.
And she was horrified.
Oh dear. Yes. Dani had never felt so alone as she did seated in the midst of the vast horde. Her brother had told her to smile, so she smiled until her face ached and the tears came unbidden to her eyes. Again, men always telling women to smile.
I know. Smile, sweetheart. It's not that bad.
Yeah, it's like...
Kill yourself.
Yeah, I don't exist to be your ornament. What the hell?
I know, it's disgusting. And then she said, you know, as the hours passed, the terror grew in Dani until all she could... It was all she could do not to scream. Oh, God. I can, you know, we can really see from her point of view how all of this is so scary. Of course, I mean, people are dying in front of you and people are having sex in front of you. If you haven't been exposed to that at the age of 13, which a lot of people haven't, well, a lot of, I guess, privileged people haven't, it's terrifying for you to see that. Absolutely terrifying.
It's just interesting, the notion of there was a study about, you know, the correlation between how big a wedding is and the rate of divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a correlation that the bigger, like the more guests there are and the bigger the whole wedding is, the less likely mm-hmm. they are to divorce. And they were trying to portray it in a positive way, but I'm just thinking... Mm-hmm. If it has such a big wedding, then clearly it's a very communal, collectivist type of culture where there's going to be pressure on them not to get divorced. That has nothing.
Yeah.
That doesn't say anything that's indicative of that the marriage itself is going to be stronger. It's just that there are community pressures.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like all these people have watched you get married, and it will just be embarrassing for you, because it's mostly the parents' friends who are in it as well. It's mm-hmm. like it's going to be so embarrassing for your parents if you get divorced. So they might not be happy, but they are still together.
Yeah, so that's kind of also in terms of when someone like Dani or any sort of bride in arranged marriages, you're in this huge, you know, celebration, and people are making such a big deal out of it and just loading on the pressure of you have to make this work, even though you're really not feeling it.
Yeah, absolutely. It comes to the burden of a woman on a woman, isn't it? Because the women are meant to make the marriage work, and if it's a failure, then it's a failure on the woman, which is just ridiculous. It's a ridiculous
notion. which is why I get really pissed off with men who like quote the statistic of like in America 70% of divorces are initiated by women.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that as a condemnation of women, that clearly they don't care about marriage and things like that. And I'm like, to me, like when someone, whoever initiates the divorce, I don't think that's indicative of who was more at fault or who tried harder or who didn't. Because if anything, I'm probably mm-hmm. thinking that, again, women are socially conditioned to be more relationship oriented and try and put in more effort, and the guy maybe did nothing and she's like, okay, I can't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Just trying to say that whoever initiates the divorce is automatically has less moral ground. I'm just like, no,
it's just ridiculous. They have more courage, if anything else.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately we get to Illyrio's wedding present.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Ah, oh, the dragon eggs. She gets the three beautiful dragon eggs that he says, you know, it's from the Shadowlands beyond Asai, and they have turned to stone with the time, but they still sparkle nonetheless.
Yeah, and she was like, at first when she looked at them, she thought they were maybe like made of glass or like porcelain, but she realized that they're like solid stone.
Yeah.
And she's like, one egg was a deep green with burnished bronze flecks that came and went depending on how Dany turned it. So that is Rhaegal. Yes. And then, yeah, another was pale cream streaked with gold. That's Viserion.
Mm-hmm.
The last was black as a midnight sea, yet alive with scarlet ripples and swirls. And that is Drogon.
Yes. Drogon.
And I just really noticed, I didn't think about it too deeply the first read earlier this year, but the idea that the conception of the dragons is completely linked directly with her relationship with Drogo and the Dothraki, that the sort of conception happens at the wedding when she first marries Tal Drogo, and then the birth of the dragons ends at Khal Drogo's funeral pyre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it begins her growth. You know, well, the growth starts, you know, the moment that she marries him. Because if you think, there's a few pages back when Viserys is throwing a fit and being like, I am the dragon, blah, blah, blah. Let's rewind. A few pages back, Viserys is throwing a fit because he wants her to marry Khal Drogo now. And he's just being like, when am I going to get my army to go and invade the Seven Kingdoms? And then Master Illyrio is telling him, you know, you will get it, just have to wait until they get married, and then, you know, it will be when the Dothraki omens, you know, when they want to, if the omens favor war. That's the one. Thank you. If the omens favor war,
which again
will happen. And then he says, I piss on Dothraki omens. I want it now. I am the dragon. And then she goes, and then she thinks in her head, like, dragons don't exist. So she's just like already sick of his shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, she's sick of it by now. And there's the notion and the fact that what a petulant child he is, because it's like, their whole culture is centered around war. Those omens will give you like the green light very like soon enough.
Yeah, like, that's exactly it.
So, and again, the whole notion of, as I mentioned in the last, you know, maybe Daenerys chapter, of is, oh my, just a minute, my cat is crying. Do you hear him?
Okay, yes.
Okay, let me go open the door. He's such a whiner.
Oh, let me in.
Yes. So, yeah, the notion of, is Illyrio investing in Viserys or investing in Dany? Because you can, with this sort of wedding gift, you can think of it as either way. Either he is, because he's directly giving the eggs to Daenerys, he is investing in her, or it could also be a very patriarchal, you know, just the notion of, she is property of men, and so by giving the eggs to her, they're automatically Viserys's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that I was wondering as to why did he give the eggs to Dany instead of Viserys, like the moment that he found it? Maybe because he thinks Viserys is so pathetic that he's just like, no, she will take care of them. She, like, is this precious, you know, these precious things that need to be kept safe with someone with morals, because I'm sure that he would say that he will sell them.
Yeah, because I'm not convinced that just being a Targaryen can give you full control of dragons. I think, you know, I'm not sure exactly what is canon in terms of, you know, dragon rider relationships, but honestly, I think
what, bacon?
Okay. What was I saying?
Oh, you were saying, yeah, you don't know what,
honestly, I think Viserys at least would not be able to control them at best, and at worst would get eaten by a dragon.
Yeah, absolutely. He would not be able to control it. He would get so frustrated with them because they're not doing exactly what they want, what he wants at the exact moment. And it would be a waste.
So I tend to like to think, and then there also is the question, did Illyrio already have the dragon eggs by the time he got hooked up with Viserys and Daenerys, or did he get them afterwards?
I don't know. I think he got them afterwards, but yeah, well, I'm not sure.
And I'm just thinking, like, where are the Are there more dragon eggs?
Maybe. You know, in the lands beyond Asai. Yes. You never know.
Like, are they supposed to be from Asai itself or even further than Asai?
Further.
Further, okay.
Further, yeah. The Shadowlands, from the Shadowlands.
And then we get the Drogo gives her the gift of the really beautiful silver mare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so lovely.
Yeah. And you see that, again, it's hard, talking about, the Dothraki culture in terms of our modern sense of like international law and like war, mm-hmm. And all those things. But again, Khal Drogo is shown to have a sensitive side because he does give her this gift that is obviously very, very important for his culture, and it means a lot to him that Daenerys like doesn't just chicken out and rides through the camp and jumps over the fire, and it that she doesn't mm-hmm. that she doesn't fuck it up.
yeah he trusts her to lead that horse, and I what did he say, that the silver mane is for the silver in her hair.
Yes.
It's thoughtful, I don't think that a person like that, because he's been so stoic and like just looked like he didn't care about her, would have given her a thoughtful gift like that.
It reminds you, the way you put it that way makes me think of Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester.
I don't know,
but yeah, the mare itself, the silver mare, made me think of Shadowfax and Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if there's any, obviously I've ridden horses. I don't know if in the specific Dothraki culture, if there are certain cultural significances to different either breeds of horses or different colors, in mm-hmm. their coat.
Yeah, it says here, custom decrees that the Khaleesi must ride a mount worthy of her place by the side of the cow.
Reading that made me think of, again, the more nomadic and the more pagan a society is, the more rights they give women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like the more settled they are, the more quote unquote civilized they are. Athens treated women like crap.
Mm. Yeah,
in ancient Greece.
Yeah, and the fact that there's Doshkalin. Yeah, who they are the ultimate rulers.
Yeah, so Khal, Khaleesi, Khalasar, Doshkhalin, the Kha is also an Arabic sound. And basically, yeah it's like you're hacking a loogie.
Kha. Am I doing it right? I don't think it's a Khal.
Khal Drogo.
Khalin. There you go.
So anyway, so he comes and gets his own horse and they ride off into the sunset, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
So you were interested in this, this sort of interaction on their wedding night. What were your thoughts?
So I think that, you wouldn't expect him to be so careful and sweet towards her, but he was. And he just kept saying no to her. No, no. I think it's it's his way of saying you're not ready yet. You're not ready yet. So he is just very soft towards her. He takes his time with her. He caresses her hair and her face, cradles her. She helps him take out his braid. So she is very much, she's very comfortable in that situation. And he couldn't show that because I think that in front of his Khalasar, he needs to be
I will
stoic.
Rip your entrails out of your stomach.
That's exactly it. So he's like, I can't show any softness because that's not how I should be presented. But with her, he's very careful. He's very gentle to her. Like there's a lot of throughout that interaction, there's a lot of lightly touched her and like carefully, silently. He's very careful with her.
Methodical.
Yes, yeah. And then, she says, but he never hurt her. And then, as things mount, as pressure mounts, at the end, he just goes, no. He asks her, no. And she goes, yes. So he waits for her consent, mm-hmm. unlike the show. He fully rapes her.
Indeed. So with this whole thing, I'm thinking about, when they, because they first start off, you know, like, no, he said. He lifted his hand and rubbed the tears roughly away from her eyes. So, because, you know, that can go both ways. That can be a no as in, oh, don't cry, as in, like, concern. Or it could be a no as in, don't cry, that annoys me, that irritates me.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that. But I think they're the complications of Drogo and Daenerys' relationship, because a lot of people, a lot of feminists, would make the argument that it doesn't matter how gentle Drogo is trying to be in this moment, because ultimately this bargain has been made without her consent. And so that, you know, some equate it to, like, just because maybe a slaveholder was quote unquote kinder to a slave, that doesn't absolve them of the fact that they were a slave, that they were a slaveholder and didn't give someone their autonomy. So there is that whole question. And one thing I did notice again in terms of Khal Drogo showing his level of intimacy, because again, the notion of, like, clothes and, like, nakedness doesn't mean anything. Like, to me, like, him showing the intimacy of her is that he's telling her to take the beads out of his hair, because we know, like, Native Americans, like, the hair is really important to in the Dothraki culture, and is a symbol of his, like, strength and power, and that he's never been defeated.
Yes. So that is, yeah, that is very intimate. That is something that he, I think, letting her do that first for him, I think he hopes to show her that he's being vulnerable to her, and she can be vulnerable to him too.
And yeah, like, and it just makes me think of, I like to think in my headcanon that even though he's not showing it, Khal Drogo is observing the dynamic between Viserys and Daenerys, and already from the get-go is realizing, oh, he's a little piece of shit.
Yeah, absolutely. He would have seen, well, the way that, you know, when she was there, like, he grabbed her thigh, like, after she came back from the horse and she was, you know, riding high, excuse the pun, and he just, like, comes up to her. He's like, yeah, now it's time for you to cultivate the marriage, and you better keep him happy, like, squeezing her thigh. I'm sure that he's, like, seeing it, and he's just like, you know, I want to show her that I'm not.
And again, it's interesting, the different masculine interpretations that I'm strong and therefore, like, beating my wife, like, I'm showing myself I'm a man, you know, whereas, you know, there's an other, you know, masculine thing, like, because I think Khal Drogo is more in the sense of, like, I am so powerful, like, I, you know, it, again, it's like, it's not a fair fight if you hit a woman. I like to think Khal Drogo is more like, you know, it's a affront to his, like, manhood and masculinity, that he could not make it, that not making his woman happy and having to resort to hitting her.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. He takes pride in keeping her happy and, you know, in making her happy instead of making her afraid of him.
Wedding night is consensual in the book and is not in the show, which, and I guess they were trying to go for, like, showing her completely, like, broken or lacking agency just to, like, build her all that much up again, which I guess if they were going to go that route, I guess it would have made more sense if they had him rape her and still had them have, like, a happy relationship until he died.
Yeah.
So maybe I just, like, I wish they would have kept it as it is in the book and, you know, keep them, oh, they have a pretty happy relationship, or have them not, like, have her adjust, but not her, not them have the most intimate relationship, or have a little emotional distance, and then he eventually dies.
Well, I think it is taken into consideration as well what you said yesterday when we were speaking about it, that because she wasn't underage in the show, then they had to make it more
terrible.
Yeah, they had to make it,
make it terrible in a different way.
Yeah, because, yeah, in the book, it's, yes, she's underage, but he's being respectful towards her. So in the show, they needed to make it like, okay, this is not okay still.
And those are our three chapters. Shall we go to our history lessons?
Let's do it.
Okay, I struggled with this one. Do you want to go first, or I don't know, I forget, I can't keep track of, you know, who goes first.
I think you went first last week, so I think I remember me saying I went first before. So I think this time I go first. So I wanted to have a look at the Dothraki and history's nomads, especially the Mongols. So the nomads are people who are defined as people who move from city to city, depending on the seasons. They have no fixed residence. And the groups of nomads include shepherds, traders, and hunters. But in the olden days, they were considered menaces to settled people. So people that, you know, have settled residences and who are ruled by one person. And they are considered odd and, you know, savages.
Yeah.
For the Greeks, there were, forgive me for my awful pronunciation, but I think it's called the Scythians. And they were described as hard-drinking barbarians. But you know why they're described as hard-drinking barbarians? Because they drink their wines undiluted, unlike the Greeks who used to dilute their wines. So that's why they were hard-drinking barbarians.
Okay.
And then we have the Huns, who a lot of people know. The Huns, they were so devoted to the riding life that they slept in the saddle of a horse. They wore tunics made of field mice, because I thought that this was interesting because Daenerys received a dress or something that was made of field mice as well. And Khal Drogo was sort of loosely based on Attila the Hun, that he was promised a hand of a Western noblewoman in exchange for protection for his army. And when he got there, the emperor completely denied his daughter's hand. And Attila the Hun clearly just went and killed him.
Yep.
But the Dothraki are most like the Mongols. The Mongols were described as they regarded robbery and violence, immorality and debauchery as deeds of manliness and excellence. And in 1219, they invaded Iran, where they killed women, men, children, ripped apart open the bodies of pregnant women, and slaughtered the unborn. And this is something that actually Robert Baratheon, later on, I think it might be the next chapter or the chapter after. So he talks to Ned about this, and he says, they go from town to town looting, burning, and killing every man who can't hide behind a stone wall, stealing our crops and livestock, enslaving all our women and children. So, yeah, there's that. And then there's also the thing that the Dothrakis most believe in, which is the stallion that mounts the world, which we'll see later in the books. And there's actually this man who... bear with me for a second. So... The most highly effective and highly dangerous leader was called Temujin, or Blacksmith. Mm-hmm. He was born in the 1100s. Yeah, and he was orphaned at the age of 9 because some rivals poisoned his father. So as he grew into a man, he recruited a band of allies and, you know, killed a bunch of people. And in 1206, he defeated rival clan leaders, and he named himself as the overall leaders of the Mongols. He called himself Singis. He called himself as Singis, and which is actually Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the universal ruler. I think Genghis Khan comes from let's call the ocean. Or strong. That's the rough translation of it, I think. From then until he died, he created the largest contiguous empire in history, stretching from the Caspian to the Pacific. So he was the real life stallion that mounts the world because, you know, he conquered
basically. He controlled all the steppes.
yeah, all the whole world. Nice. Mongolia was also seen as the real life Dothraki, with very few Europeans making the journey and even less making it out. Mm-hmm. Genghis Khan, something that is like the last thing that I will say about it is that Genghis Khan executed a high-ranking official by having molten gold poured over his head.
Oh, that really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad we have that Iron Fire and Ice book by Ed West. I know.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, it's just interesting to read about the Dothraki and to try to, like, again, not judge them for very superficial, again, you know,
mm-hmm.
where they are technologically or, you know, in terms of nomadic versus settled. Because it's interesting because I always hear about the Mongols, the very bad side of it, because, you know, my husband is Persian and, you know, in Persia was very much, you know, a very settled, like the language, the poetry, like all the books, like it was a very mm-hmm. sort of quote unquote highbrow society. And then, you know, the Mongols just completely wiped them out. And so they've all, from the Persian mm-hmm. side, naturally, they're portrayed as absolutely horrible that just razed the entire country, you know, to the ground.
Yeah.
And burned it all and pillaged and, you know, did all these horrible things. And again, just the notion of, like, with not the Mongols, but with the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths, like in Europe, you know, battling the Romans, this sense of, like, the Romans could not understand how, like, the Goths were all into, like, conquering and the glory, but then they left. Like, they had no political ambition to, like, maintain the area. Mm-hmm. Like, just that cultural difference, you know, same with the Dothraki.
Yeah, I think, this is just me reading, of course, from recounts of people who, you know, were in a different society than the Mongols and the nomads. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is acceptable to one set of people is not acceptable to the other. So, obviously not passing any judgment on anything. But obviously, if you are killing pregnant women and ripping their newborns out of their wombs, it's not great.
Alrighty then. So my history lesson, I wanted to save a little bit of the Dothraki stuff, you know, for later. So I kind of focused on the notion of Viserys as the sort of beggar king, as he's mm-hmm. called, and just made me think of, again, like, these strategic alliances are made, and that's, you know, arranged marriages is nothing new, but the even those who are highly, a lot of times it's highly powerful people, you know, trying mm-hmm. to get with each other and maintain the power. So this is a situation where Viserys has literally nothing and is, like, basically being a quote-unquote gold digger to, mm-hmm. you know, get the resources that he wants. Yeah. And totally, like, the thing I thought of most is actually the British peers in the late 19th and early 20th century who would marry American heiresses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, British lords who were either, you know, had these estates but had no, like, liquid assets and, you know, money mm-hmm. and things were changing. And they're like, holy crap, I'm going to lose, like, the mansion and, like, all my farm's tenants and, like, all these things. I need, like, cash now. And so the whole thing about, you know, marrying these American heiresses and bringing them into England and what, even though the British lords didn't have the money, the women, the American heiresses were bringing the money, but they were bringing, like, the prestige and the way Americans, you know, to this day still, like, fetishized the, you know, notion of these lords and the peerage system and all that crap. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just what I was thinking of. And that, you know, that was the whole basis for the hit masterpiece drama series Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea was that Robert, like the Earl of Grantham, mm-hmm. he actually did not love his wife in the beginning and pursued her solely for, mm-hmm. you know, riches and things like that. But then they ended up genuinely starting to, like each other and love each other, which is, again, kind of similar to, you know, Khal Drogo. Khal Drogo is not even thinking about, you know, I doubt Khal Drogo is even thinking about any sort of prestige of, oh, the last bloodline of the Valyrian or anything. Like,
he isn't.
He's not thinking about those things in any way, shape, or form. But
no, he just wants a wife.
He wants a wife, and I think he generally just wanted something, like, different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, because he is, you know, the best warrior, so he wants unique. He wants someone who can, he wants to break the wheel.
In a way. So yeah, so that's all I had, because again, I wanted to save some of the Mongol stuff, you know, for later with the you know, Vast Dothrak and Dosh Khalin.
Yeah, it's difficult to really get into the juicy bits in the beginning.
And now we can move on to friendship lessons. Do you want to go or shall I?
I'll go. I don't know if you're going to like this, but it is what we touched upon, that it comes from Jon Snow, and don't involve your friends in personal drama. I don't know, maybe I adapted to a very like British way of having friendships, because before I would get really annoyed that, like, if I had drama with, like, another person that my friends knew, I would hope that they would stick to my side and, like, and would just completely shun that person. But now that I've grown up a little bit, and I think, yeah, I've adapted to a little bit of a British set of mind, I just think that, like, if you got beef with someone, don't bring your friends into it, because it's not their issue. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not about enabling shitty behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like superficial, I guess, because if it is like something shitty that someone's doing, then yeah, of course I would expect them to step in.
Yeah, well, I think it all depends on what is your beef with that specific person, and does it warrant, you know, external condemnation or not. Because for a very long time with my husband's, you know, his ex-girlfriend was very antagonistic, tried to like do things to sabotage our relationship and saying horrible things about my husband. And in the beginning, I wasn't upset with people, like people in our social circle, like staying out of it, because we weren't trying to bring them in to it at all. It was the ex-girlfriend trying to like rally people to her side. We weren't saying anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that way, like, I kind of understood why people were staying out of it. But then I got to a point where the ex's behavior became so excessive, and in some ways making me wonder if my physical safety was at risk. Mm-hmm. And so once it got to that level, I started to get angry that people were just hiding, you know, and not wanting to say anything because they didn't want to deal with her crap.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't want her crap to, like, you know, come and haunt them. So it's a tough situation, because it's like, because I tend to naturally think that, yes, it's your beef with a specific someone, but I also don't want to be like, oh, if it's not affecting me, then it's not my problem. Like, be so selfish that as long as I'm not inconvenienced, like, if someone is genuinely doing something bad to someone else, even though technically it's not my business, I would think, why are they doing that to that person? Like, and they could potentially do it to me, but like, in some ways I view it as like selfish. It's like, as long as it doesn't bother me, that's fine.
The thing is, I set that standard to people, but I don't follow it myself, because I will get involved. And like, you know, with friends, I'm very much like, I will fuck other people up, even though they haven't done anything to me. But, you know, I've experienced things where it's like, it's not fair on pushing people to take your side, even though, yeah, they should be on your side, as long as they are aware of the type of person. But yeah, in the situation that you were in, of course, like, they shouldn't have stayed out of it if your safety was compromised. It's enabling shitty behavior that is not good.
Yeah. But that, yeah, that's a good one. It is a very, you know, hard one, because again, it varies exactly on case by case. My friendship lesson also comes from John, but it comes from John, you know, giving the little gift of needle to Arya.
Mm-hmm.
So mine is encourage your friends to pursue their strengths, whether or not it appears useful in the moment or is considered conventional to like anyone's, you know, standards, because as you said earlier, John can hone in on this is what Arya's really is good at and she's passionate about, and he takes the time to give her something that he knows she really, really will like. Because I'm sort of thinking, yeah, so she's encouraging her to embrace her true self and to hone in on the skills that aren't necessarily conventional for a woman of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because that made me think of, you know, again, even though it doesn't seem relevant at the moment, it will become relevant later, I always feel like, because I had a teacher in high school where she told us that, you know, she really wanted to take German when she was a kid in high school and learn that language. And her parents were like, oh, what good use is that? We're in the United States. Learn Spanish. That's much more efficient and makes more sense. And guess what? Her husband is German.
Wow.
So again, even if something doesn't seem relevant or seems stupid, like, always encourage your friends to like hone in on their skills and develop them, regardless of what other people may be saying, what other naysayers may be about.
Yeah, I love that. That was actually almost going to be mine. Almost. But
almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Not as eloquent as you put it. Mine was going to be like, give friends special gifts.
Alrighty then. And thus concludes our chapters with the three heads of the dragon.
Who is exciting?
Who is after this?
So we have Ned.
Tyrion.
Yeah, Ned is next. Tyrion again.
Tyrion, and then I'm imagining Catelyn after that. Yes, Catelyn.
Ugh. I don't want to read anything more from this woman. I know we have a long way to go.
We have a long way till the red wedding. I don't care about her.
Yeah, I just don't care about her. She got what she deserved. All I want is to get to that point where I'm just like, ha ha! Obviously, Rob didn't deserve it, but she did.
Oh, yes, of course. Alrighty, so stay tuned for that, everyone. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media. Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMare Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.